The Week in Philly on KYW News Radio is recorded and edited every Friday afternoon. For the latest updates to any of the stories you're about to hear, listen to KYW News Radio anytime on your smart speaker or the Odyssey or iHeartRadio apps. Visit kywnewsradio.com or follow us on social media at KYW News Radio.
This is The Week in Philly from KYW News Radio, sponsored by your Delaware Valley Honda dealers. Get a deal you'll like on a Honda you'll love.
Welcome to our weekly look at the stories that have been making headlines in Philadelphia and the region. My name is Matt Leon, and over the next hour, we will bring in KYW News Radio reporters to break down the stories you have been talking about. The federal government puts up new panels telling their version of the story of the President's House on Independence Mall.
The nine enslaved people are all together on one tiny panel.
Pat Loeb will have that story, and then we will get all the details of Pennsylvania's nearly $51 billion budget.
It passed both chambers with strong bipartisan support.
Jim Melwert will break it all down. It's never good when explosive diarrhea is in the headlines.
I would expect it to get worse before it gets better.
Dr. Brian McDonough will tell us all about the cyclospora parasite. Then Mike DiNardo braces us for the traffic headaches the upcoming closure of the Market Street Bridge will cause.
11,000 cars cross that bridge each weekday.
Justin Udo tells us about concerns in a Delaware County community that a liquefied natural gas plant could be on the way.
They are saying that the elected leaders are doing things shrouded in secrecy.
And then Sheridan Howard tells us about a special phone in Love Park.
And this phone gave him an ability to share those feelings and those emotions.
All that is ahead over the next hour. I hope you'll join us for The Week in Philly from KYW News Radio. And we will get started right after this.
This is much bigger than changing the story of slavery in Philadelphia. This is changing the history of America.
We start this edition of The Week in Philly talking about the President's House on Independence Mall. Now, we have talked a lot about the lengthy court battles over who gets to tell the story of the history of the President's House, specifically the history of slavery under our first President George Washington. Well, after those lengthy court battles, this week, new materials were installed. And for more, let's bring in KYW City Hall Bureau Chief Pat Loeb. So, Pat, what happened this week?
On Tuesday night, workers from the National Park Service went to the President's House, took down any of the display panels that were left up, which that was only about half of them, because this was part of an operation that had started earlier in the year. And they disconnected all of the monitors. The monitors are still up, but they're blank. And they put up new panels that tell a whole new story about the President's House exhibit.
So how do these new panels compare to the old ones?
Well, the original exhibit was about the people who lived in the house as slaves, not as presidents. The house had been torn down decades ago, and when its remains were discovered, scholars realized that what they were looking at, what had survived, was the slave quarters in the basement. So the lens of the exhibit was on the nine people who lived in those quarters. The new exhibit is about the house, the presidents who lived there, the people who came to visit. Even Benedict Arnold, the namesake of treason, gets his own panel. The nine enslaved people are all together on one tiny panel. The entire focus has shifted.
Now, the city had fought this hard in court. Do they have any comment on this move?
Yes. Mayor Parker, who sued when the exhibit was first taken down, and that was long before the Park Service ever mentioned putting up new panels, she issued a statement that noted the Park Service had acted under cover of darkness. The changes, as I said, were made Tuesday night. She said that doing it at night was a sign that the government knew that what it was doing was shameful, her word.
And we mentioned we've already had lengthy court battles going back and forth over this. Is this over from a legal standpoint? Does the city have a card it could play? Where do we go from here?
When the mayor says she'll ask for a rehearing of the legal issues in the Third Circuit Court's ruling that the exhibit materials could be replaced, and the Avenging the Ancestors Coalition, ATAC, which was the driving force behind the original exhibit, says they're going to keep fighting too. So I guess the answer is no, it's not over. But no one was specific about what the next steps might be.
All right, we'll keep an eye on it. And let's switch gears now. This week we learned the city of Philadelphia is going to continue to send its trash to Chester to be incinerated. What are the details here?
Yes, well, the city finally, after 7 years, had to execute new trash disposal contracts this year. And a lot of people saw it as a chance to end the practice of burning trash. City officials from Chester, advocates, and city council member Jamie Gauthier and some of her colleagues all said, let's take this opportunity to come up with a new way to dispose of the city's trash. They worked on it for months, and then the city announced it was planning to re-up with ReWorld, which owns the incinerator. So it's back to the status quo. Business as usual, we're burning the trash.
And we don't seem to know much about this new contract, do we?
Absolutely nothing, except who gets the contracts. We don't know the cost. We don't know the terms. We've been asking for more than a week with no answer. And Gauthier said something about that that sort of echoes what the mayor said about the President's House exhibit.
You do not hide things that you are proud of. You hide things that you're ashamed of.
She sees the very fact that the mayor's being so secretive about these new contracts as a bad sign.
All right. Thank you very much, Pat. That's KYW City Hall Bureau Chief Pat Loeb joining us. We are just getting started on this edition of The Week in Philly. Much more to bring you. Don't go anywhere.
This is the fourth year in a row where, despite working with one of the only divided legislatures in the entire country, we stayed at the table, brought Democrats and Republicans together to get stuff done again.
This is The Week in Philly, and Pennsylvania has a budget. Governor Josh Shapiro signed the nearly $51 billion budget into state law on Sunday. So what's in it? For that and much more, let's bring in KYW Suburban Bureau Chief Jim Melward. And Jim, before we get into the numbers, unlike last year where this process dragged on comically almost for months past the quote-unquote deadline, this week legislators got to the finish line only about 2 weeks late. Why was this year so much less dramatic?
Well, cynics would probably say because it's an election year with every state rep and half the state senate up for re-election this fall and the governor. When a budget stalemate spills into the fall, like November last year, people actually start to feel the pain, especially school districts and local government or those who rely on local government. Aside from the cynics, the people responsible for the budget say they rolled up their sleeves and despite a divided government with Democrats controlling the House and the governor's office and Republicans holding the state Senate, they realized that no one could wait for a perfect budget. And they made compromises to create the best product they could under the circumstances. And they also held off on trying to tackle the more controversial issues, again, in election year.
As far as what's in this budget, what would you say are the headlines here?
Well, it passed both chambers with strong bipartisan support, 44-6 in the Senate, 167-35 in the House. So clearly had pretty solid support from both parties. It doesn't touch the rainy day fund. I think that's the one that you'll hear incumbents touting as we get into election season. At least it doesn't this year. As Senate Republican leader Joe Pittman puts it, they pulled $1.5 billion out of the couch cushions of bureaucracy. Other fiscal hawks in the legislature, though, say instead of cutting spending or increasing revenues, it just defers potentially billions in spending and will cause headaches down the road. One described it as cooking the books Al Capone style. In total, it's a $50.8 billion budget, a 3.7% increase over last year. It's about $2.5 billion less than what Governor Josh Shapiro proposed. It continues what's called adequacy funding for public schools with $500+ million going to that, to the most in-need districts in Pennsylvania, along with increases, additional increases in basic education, special education, school safety, mental health, along with workforce development and career and tech ed, in hopes of reducing wait lists in what's called CTE now, career and tech ed, reducing wait lists for the high demand programs. There's also $775 million for local roads and bridges and a cost of living increase to teachers, firefighters, cops, and other public service workers who retired before 2001.
Anything Philadelphia-centric of note that really jumped out at you?
I would say most noteworthy for Philadelphia is the Philadelphia School District gets more than $130 million of that $500-plus million adequacy funding. The legislature also closed a loophole that allowed online retailers to avoid collecting the city's additional 2% sales tax. City officials say that equals about $1.5 million per year. There's funding to battle homelessness in Philadelphia, and the city also gets about $25 million of that pot for local roads and bridges for repair within the city.
He talked about kind of the controversial items that were not addressed or not tackled. Seemed to me the things that jumped out was skill games and kind of the long-term financial health of mass transit.
I would say those two, the two you mentioned, skill games, mass transit. Also, minimum wage has been a long-term issue, legalized marijuana, and the plan that would have limited a sales and use tax exemption for data center developers, though this does include reporting requirements on electric and water usage for larger data centers. The mass transit didn't get attention this year as Governor Shapiro's Band-Aid plan last year to prevent those proposed SEPTA cuts was a two-year plan, so it covered this year as well. That'll raise its head back up next year. And the legislature is going to have to decide what to do with the so-called skill games, as a recent PA Supreme Court ruling gives the legislature until October. If there's no action, then those machines will be labeled illegal gambling devices. Minimum wage, the governor and Democrats in the legislature have been pushing for it to go from what the current $7.25 an hour to $15 an hour. They point to an increase in income tax revenue and also savings at the state level from safety net programs like Medicaid. And despite every bordering state to Pennsylvania except West Virginia offering adult use cannabis, the legislature still has yet to reach an agreement on a plan there. That's also, depending on whose estimates you use, hundreds of millions with an M, hundreds of millions of dollars annually.
So you mentioned Governor Josh Shapiro, the Democrat, is running for re-election in the fall, and he is running in large part on the idea that he gets stuff done. I think you and I and most people think he has presidential ambitions. This budget agreement would seem to raise his stock even higher, no? Like, only a couple weeks late compared to last year, you know, got it across the finish line, and what's next?
Yeah, the divided government and being able to reach an agreement and compromise, et cetera, et cetera. So in Governor Shapiro's eyes, sure. I'd say this entire plan works well for incumbents who are up for election or have greater political ambitions, as they can say they work toward a balanced budget with no tax hike. It keeps the rainy day fund untouched. But you can be assured opponents, including Republican Stacey Garrity, who is challenging Governor Shapiro for the fall, will argue that there were accounting maneuvers in this budget to get it across the line. And they'll say it's not really balanced as much as just kicking the can down the road.
All right. Thank you very much, Jim. That's KYW Suburban Bureau Chief Jim Melward joining us. We need to step away. We will continue with the Week in Philly right after this. It's the Week in Philly, sponsored by your Delaware Valley Honda dealers. Get a deal you'll like on a Honda you'll love. Welcome back to the Week in Philly. And among the many things we have to worry about these days is a microscopic parasite. The U.S. is experiencing an outbreak of the cyclospora parasite, which can most alarmingly cause serious issues with diarrhea. Now let's learn more about this parasite now as we check in with KYW medical editor Dr. Brian McDonough. And first off, Dr. McDonough, what exactly is this?
When you talk about the term parasite, a parasite is something that lives on you or lives on another living object and doesn't give anything back. In other words, it's just taking. In this case, it's a microscopic parasite, something we can't see, but it gets into your body and it replicates and it starts taking things it wants from your body, but it also causes problems in the person that it has infected.
Now, we recently heard that one major outbreak across several states is linked to shredded lettuce served at Taco Bell, but the CDC says there are other outbreaks that are unrelated. So how does this parasite travel in general? How can one become infected?
It travels in water. It can be found in fresh fruit. It can be found in lettuce, even now swimming pools, lakes. So you somehow ingest it and it gets into your system.
When it comes to avoiding it, I guess, obviously, wash anything you bring into the house from a vegetable fruit standpoint. But just in some casual reading up on this, it sounds like a cursory rinse. You need to do more than that. Am I overstating?
No, I think you should thoroughly wash, especially things, fruits and vegetables. You really got to wash them. And I would wash them aggressively. The other thing is, you know, you reduce the chances maybe if you get something from a reputable farmer or something. The more hands that touch this, the more opportunity for cyclosporin to be there. So, if, you know, if it's processed in a plant, it goes from here to there and it's at your store. I'd be very careful about washing everything thoroughly because you're like the last person who gets it and you can get rid of a lot of it. Obviously, if you cook it and you cook it, it's destroyed by heat. The problem is the places we're getting it from are things you're not going to cook. You're not going to be heating up lettuce. Obviously, if it's a vegetable that you're cooking, you don't have to worry about it.
This sounds like this could be intense diarrhea for multiple days, if not weeks.
Here's what's tough about it. First of all, it takes a while for you to even get the symptoms. It can be like 5-7 days later, so it's hard to track it. Then what happens is you get flu-like symptoms. You might get stomach ache, fever, and yeah, this diarrhea comes on. It can be explosive, it can dehydrate you, and it can be a problem. But even worse than that, you kind of get through it and you go, oh man, I was really hit with a tough bug. And then it comes back, and it can come back again and again. And if you're someone, your immune system's not as good, you're higher risk, you're very old, very young, it can be a big problem because you get dehydrated faster and it becomes an issue. So that's why we're so concerned about it.
As far as treatment, what's the protocol? Like if you go to the doctor with this, what should you expect as far as fighting it?
Well, one of the things we're doing now is because we're aware of it as doctors, like in practice, is we're going to test for it. But as far as treatments, there's a drug called trimethoprim sulfa. Brand names are Bactrim, Septra. It's a medication, you know, it's out there. It's not that expensive. It's something you can get. That medication can treat it. So if your physician or healthcare provider thinks that you have this, first of all, they will treat you. But also, if you're having a problem, talk to your doctor, get in there, get seen, because you don't want it to continue.
I know there have been a lot of cuts at the federal level as far as disease monitoring and stuff like that. Is there a connection there? Why are we seeing the numbers we're seeing?
I can't stress this enough. Public health is where we've made our major advances in the last 3-4 decades. If we don't continue to take care of our people through public health, what we're going to get is what we expect. Organisms like this, parasites, they don't have a budget. They just come after you. If we're not testing it early or detecting it by testing our fruits, vegetables, those things early on, it's going to get out there. So what we're seeing, sadly, is more and more of these things happening. And I think we're just at the tip of the iceberg. We're going to have new common things. And my other concern is people traveling from afar coming into the country. If we're not testing things, unfortunately, we can go after this and we're trying to warn people, but this could have been done a lot earlier, to your point.
Should we expect this cyclosporin situation to get worse? Have we peaked, or is this not the type of thing that has a peak?
I would expect it to get worse before it gets better because we're still in the middle of the summer. Usually these things play out and usually, you know, it's not as big of an issue. But again, we're not really getting the data that we need on the front end. So it's hard to tell. Maybe we're learning lessons from this. Maybe, you know, people at CDC and other organizations are, you know, are going to kind of rise up and say, we got to do this for people's care. I know a lot of public health people are out there speaking.
That's KYW Medical Editor Dr. Brian McDonough. We need to take a break. We will continue with this edition of The Week in Philly right after this.
We are aiming to close Market Street for about 14 months come the end of August, tentatively scheduled for around August 24th.
We are back on this edition of The Week in Philly, and I don't know if it's just me, but I really feel like there's just construction going on everywhere. Are you tired of it too? I hear you. Well, here's a story about some more construction, and for more, let's bring in KYW's Mike DiNardo. Mike, we are talking about the Market Street Bridge, and correct me if I'm wrong, but they're getting ready to resume work that had already started, right? What are the details here?
Correct. This is something we can't talk about enough, it seems. This is the bridge that carries traffic over the Schuylkill River. Technically, it includes the bridges over the CSX tracks on the east side and the Schuylkill Expressway and Amtrak on the west side. But yes, essentially, we're talking about the 94-year-old span over the Schuylkill. It's deteriorating and PennDOT needs it to be rehabbed. And the bridge is going to be partially torn down and replaced in a $149 million project that will completely close the bridge for 14 months. Shall we say that again? It'll completely close the bridge for more than a year. Here's PennDOT spokesman Brad Rudolph.
It's going to be congested down there, but we really need to demo this bridge and replace this structure.
PennDOT plans to redeck the bridge, build new sidewalks, and add bike lanes. This work has been going on since March of 2025 with lane closures to accommodate utility work, but you may have noticed that the work has slowed down around here lately.
And that begs the question, why did they stop the work or slow things down earlier?
Just like you would clean your house before a company comes over, the city and state wanted to put their best foot forward for visitors for the 250th celebrations, the World Cup, and the MLB All-Star Game. So they put that construction on hold. But it is ramping up again starting this Monday, the 20th, with those lane closures coming back.
I think sometimes it's hard for people to visualize what a road closure or a bridge closure will mean. So kind of dig in for us for commuters, short term, long term. What kind of traffic issues are we going to be looking at?
Short term, starting Monday the 20th, lane closures resume. Look for the center lane on Market between Schuylkill Avenue and 30th Street to be closed once again. And also the westbound lanes of the Schuylkill Expressway will be closed in the area next week between 9 p.m. and 5 a.m. Traffic will be detoured off at 30th Street, up Schuylkill Avenue, and then back to the ramp to 76 West on the other side of the 30th Street station. But Matt, those are some of the short-term inconveniences. On about August 24th, PennDOT will completely close the Market Street Bridge for 14 months, more than a year. 11,000 cars cross that bridge each weekday, and they're all going to have to find a new way. Not to mention that during those 14 months, there will be 5 weekends where the Schuylkill Expressway will close in both directions, the first of which will be sometime this fall. So lots of inconvenience.
Talk to me about what the detours are going to look like.
Essentially, westbound traffic will be detoured onto Walnut Street. Eastbound traffic will be routed onto Chestnut Street, just south of Market Street. Westbound cars can use JFK Boulevard as well to cross the river if they want to go in that direction. And that's if you're driving. If you are walking, there is good news for you. PennDOT does plan to keep one sidewalk on one side of the bridge open so that people can walk across. Cyclists, though, people on bikes, will be detoured to Walnut and Chestnut as well.
And you said 14 months a couple of times. So when should everything get back to normal?
What is normal? But if we do the math, and PennDOT has done the math, they expect to reopen the finished rebuilt Market Street Bridge in October of 2027. That is 2027.
This directly affects me, so I am a little, since we are right outside the Market Street Bridge, that I was not consulted on the length and depth of this project.
We've been reporting on this for a while, and I get the feeling we're going to continue to do that.
All right. Thank you very much, Mike. KYW's Mike DiNardo joining us. We've still got a lot to get to on this edition of The Week in Philly. We'll be right back. The Week in Philly from KYW News Radio is sponsored by your Delaware Valley Honda dealers, proud sponsor of the KYW News Radio studios. Bring on the fun and bring home a new Honda with a great deal on your favorite Honda vehicles and finally take that road trip you've been dreaming of. Now's the time to check out the Honda Civic at HRV from Honda, the 2025 Kelley Blue Book's KBB.com best value brand.
And what they are proposing to put in Eddystone will be no more.
Welcome back to The Week in Philly. And this week, we learned about concern in a Delaware County town about the possibility of a liquefied natural gas plant being built there. For more on this, let's bring in KYW's Justin Udo. And Justin, give us the backstory here. What's happening in Eddystone?
Well, Matt, look at what's happening in Eddystone. We actually have to go back a few years to see what happened or what was going to happen in Chester. That's where we had two development corporations that were proposing putting that LNG facility in Chester on that waterfront there. But residents, they fought hard, fought tooth and nail to make sure that wouldn't happen. Now, when it comes to LNG, when it comes to liquefied natural gas, there are a number of things that people are worried about why they don't want it in their neighborhood.
Liquefied natural gas is toxic, poisonous, and it's dangerous.
It can also lead to explosions. So after the residents in Chester fought against that, we kind of had a small lull, and then we see that these companies want to bring this LNG facility to its neighboring town of Eddystone, which also has some waterfront property. And so now what we're getting and what we're hearing is the Township, the borough, has working to seize eminent domain on some waterfront property, which residents are now worried about that could potentially be an LNG facility.
But kind of following up on that, it seems like at this point, concrete details are tough to come by.
They very much are. I know this story has been ongoing for a few years now, and anytime I've reached out to council to see, hey, why are you claiming eminent domain on this land or what's going on here? Mum's been the word. I haven't received any kind of feedback back, but neighbors and whether it's the Delaware River keepers or the Chester residents concerned for quality living, they all are putting the pieces together and saying, hey, this is what we're seeing. This has been the motion in the past. So it kind of aligns with what we think is going to happen. And they are saying that the elected leaders are doing things shrouded in secrecy. And they really just want answers.
Dig in more into what the activist concerned community members are talking about, telling you why they think this is bad.
They're concerned for a number of reasons. One, because they feel that their elected officials are not being upfront with them about what's going on. Two, because how large this facility could be, it will disrupt the way of life in these Delaware County towns, where they say the LNG that will come out of these facilities will produce these large ships that will be up and down the river daily. Another, as I said, the poisonous gas and the explosion possibilities that it brings to the towns and to neighboring towns, which puts them on alert. And two, they say it's very simple to just look at what government recommendations are, is that LNG facilities should not be close to neighborhoods and they should be pretty far out.
It cannot be put into a residential community. As a matter of fact, the federal government says you're supposed to put these things out in remote areas, far away from where people live.
You mentioned in your first answer how originally it looked like this was going to be in Chester, and they were able to stave that off, activists and residents. Are you expecting the same playbook to be used here to try to stop this?
So the difference between what happened in Chester and what's going on now in Eddystone is Chester really was organized, because when it comes to different environmental issues in Chester, they have that residents' concern for quality living. They've been fighting against whether it's the facilities to burn trash or different things that go on. So they have a mobilized group of people that are fighting against these things, which doesn't necessarily exist in Eddystone now. So Chester, I think it was easier for them to kind of come together to unify and to fight against this. In Eddystone, what we're seeing are these Chester residents really informing the people there to let them know what's happening so that they can mobilize and they can fight back against this. So I think if anything, if they become more concerned about this, we're going to see people come out in higher numbers against this. And, you know, the other day, the council in Eddystone voted to claim eminent domain on that waterfront piece of property. There may not have been any mention of them putting that facility there, but we did see people from Steamfitters Union coming out and speaking on behalf of them claiming eminent domain on that property. So there are people that are for it. As we know, we have Pennsylvania Senator McCormick, who is also a proponent of LNG. So there are different pieces that are there that just aren't connected yet. But if the residents, I think, educate themselves, they can kind of see what's going on.
And going back to the idea that this is kind of people have to kind of piece this together, it is rather secretive. We don't really have any idea of specific details or a timeline, I'm guessing, right?
We do not. You know, when it comes to piecing things together, they're claiming eminent domain and saying in that area, traffic is really bad and they want to, create a new roadway there. So that's what they're going forward with. So, like I said, there's no timeline. There's speculation, but it's theory over speculation right now, because they are able to kind of go through that scientific method and see just what's going on.
I am curious, though, is there a chance they're wrong? I mean, I know how it looks and nobody's giving you answers, so you can assume the worst, but is it possible they're wrong?
It is very possible they're wrong. But the thing you want to keep in mind is there's been no transparency from those elected officials. So they could be wrong. They could be all the way in left field, which you know, is fine, but it would be easier and there would be, they'd be able to rest at night and people wouldn't have these concerns if they got the upfront answers they were looking for from their elected officials. So I think with their lack of question or their lack of answers and the lack of transparency, it's really causing worry.
All right. Thank you very much, Justin. That is KYW's Justin Udo joining us. We will have more of this edition of The Week in Philly coming up in just a few moments. Don't go anywhere.
Just talk. So I've been feeling overwhelmed lately. I'm blessed to have a great job, but things are expensive. It's hard sometimes to make ends meet. Sorry, I'm getting a little emotional, but I'm grateful. And, you know, the thing is that gratitude shouldn't have to erase the fact that sometimes life is just hard in general. But I try to just continue to be positive.
Final segment for this edition of The Week in Philly. And for this final segment, we wanted to focus on a really moving social experiment we have been seeing in Love Park. And for more on this, let's bring in KYW's Shara Day Howard. Shara, what is the Let's Talk program?
Let's Talk is the brainchild of Dan Horan. He's a Bucks County videographer who ventured into, social media. He thought, let's do some content creation, but I want to do it with a purpose. So he started out with a whiteboard, and the whiteboard had a terrible ending. You know, it was run over by a car. But he said that gave him the idea to maybe take it up a notch. So the whiteboard, he would write a question in Love Park and someone would come through, anyone, and they could just write the answer. And he started noticing that people were responding, and he'd put that back up on social media. And the comments, he said people were loving each other and so supportive in the comments. So he said, how can I take this up a notch without the whiteboard? And he came upon this phone that can plug into his camera. And he said, wow, let's just wipe the dust off of this phone and let's make something beautiful out of it. And he really did. Plugged it in and let it roll. And people started showing up. They saw him on Instagram and they would just show up and talk to their aunt, talk to their uncle, talk to their grandmother who had passed away, talk to the loved ones who are no longer here, or maybe even loved ones who were here and they just couldn't say it to their face.
Because I wanted to talk to my loved ones that's in heaven. It gives me an opportunity to really express how I feel. I'm glad I got a chance to talk, so now I feel better.
They were having conversations that they wish they could have in person. And they were talking to him, they were talking to God. And they just leave it out there. And he posts every week. He shares that. Everyone knows he shares it. And somehow that built a community.
What are some of the messages he's heard?
So you have people walking from the courts across the street who were going through a difficult time in their personal life. And then you have others who are having health problems. There was a woman, Brenda, who was having heart problems, and she was only 35. And she didn't have family. And all she could reach out to in the moment was just the ether.
Never think that somebody could pick up a phone in Center City and JFK, you know, to tell somebody how you feel.
There was another woman who was an animator, and she wanted to talk about her son, and she wanted to just talk to herself. She said it was like a mirror, and maybe talking out loud would give her some answers. Another guy said it was hard for him as a man to show emotion, to allow that vulnerability, and this phone gave him an ability, an outlet to share those feelings and those emotions.
How surprised is he by how deep and raw this became?
I could see it in his face. I could see it in what he was doing. When I watched him, he would speak to the people after they hung up the phone. He would give them a look before they picked up the phone, like, you're in a safe space. And then once they hung up, he would have a conversation with them. He was available to them because now he was emotionally involved. He was invested. He had skin in the game.
How long will this continue?
As long as he, you know, feels like there's a place for it, there's a purpose for it, and people keep coming and picking up the phone.
That's KYW's Shara Day Howard joining us, and that will do it for this edition of The Week in Philly from KYW News Radio, sponsored by your Delaware Valley Honda dealers. Get a deal you'll like on a Honda you'll love. This week's episode was produced by Sabrina Boyd-Circa and Brian Seltzer. My name is Matt Leon. Thanks so much for listening, and enjoy the rest of your weekend.